Patrician and plebeian cultures. The problem for historians has been that the 18th century is often viewed through the prism of class. The descriptions used in the 17th century are not adequate for the 18th century, and thus historians tend to use terms such as the labouring poor or the lower orders. Some divide their studies at the pivotal year of 1750, seeing closer links between the popular culture of the early 18th century and the early modern world, and linking the second half of the century with the emergence of the working class. E.P. Thompson was very influential in arguing that 18th century popular culture was a precursor of the emergence of the Victorian working class. Thus, in his famous preface to The Making of the English Working Class, he identified who he meant. He wrote, "I am seeking to rescue the poor stockinger, the Luddite cropper, the obsolete handloom weaver, the utopian artisan, and even the deluded follower of Joanna Southcote from the enormous condescension of posterity." It was Thompson who first propounded the patrician-plebeian dichotomy, a thesis which is still well established, and which accorded with the views of contemporary commentators such as Oliver Goldsmith and Henry Fielding. It has, however, come under attack from some recent postmodernist studies. Thus, Kathleen Wilson, in her influential book The Sense of the People, employed a different definition of the term popular. She sums up her approach thus. The term popular is used, like populist, to describe language or arguments that are supported by, or that champion, the rights of the people in political debate and activities. She goes on to say that her examination of popular politics is an investigation of socially inclusive or accessible forms of political activity. She is determined to adopt an inclusive definition, positing that a dichotomous approach, emphasising high versus low, patrician versus plebeian, etc., only exaggerates the role of the middling sort and conceals the extent to which popular culture was a shared culture. However, if members of all social groups could appropriate all aspects of political activity, the question has to be, what is exactly popular politics? The danger with Wilson's definition is that although it seeks to be inclusive, it's so extensive that it ceases to have any meaning at all. Elite politics remains the prerogative of the aristocracy and of the middling sorts, politics where the mass of the population are excluded by dint of their illiteracy, their status, or their poverty. Popular politics, using her definition, though, can also be the domain of the elite, with the rest of the population appropriating cultural forms when and if the context was right. There is also a suspicion that by adopting this definition, it is possible to pay lip service to the social historian's vision of the popular, whilst in reality describing a world populated by those more familiar to traditional political historians. This suspicion is reinforced when you look at Wilson's specific examples. Her chapter entitled Print, People and Culture in the Urban Renaissance describes a world familiar to readers of Peter Borsay, R.J. Morris and John Money, an urban landscape with a developing print culture, a network of political, literary and social clubs and societies, an evolution of a voluntary welfare system. Of course, the mass of the population were in contact with this world, but as recipients of its various outputs, rather than as participating members. The people, then, are not activists in this vision of 18th century politics. The political and cultural initiatives come from above. Popular culture, then, is an elusive concept. Although there is a rough agreement that it encompasses the common people's world of work, attitudes to the natural world, education, literacy and knowledge, health practices, gender and generational roles, religious beliefs, recreational and leisure pursuits, and community customs. John Clare, the Northamptonshire farm labourer and poet, remembered the rich oral culture of his father's era, writing, "My father could read a little in a Bible or Testament, and was very fond of the superstitious tales that hawked about a sheet of penny, such as Old Nixon's prophecies, Mother Bunch's fairy tales, and Mother Shipton's legacy. And he was likewise fond of ballads, and I have heard him make a boast of it over his horn of ale with his merry companions at the Bluebell public house, which was next door, that he could sing or recite above 100. E.P. Thompson noted that relations between the gentry and labouring people in the 18th century have often been characterised as paternalist. However, he also recognised that masters complained that the labouring poor were becoming more subordinate and undisciplined. For example, in the popular rhyme, "The labouring poor, in spite of double pay, are saucy, mutinous and beggarly." Daniel Defoe, in his pamphlet entitled "The Great Law of Subordination Considered, or the Insolence and Unsufferable Behaviour of Servants in England Duly Inquired To," which he wrote in 1724, argued that through the insubordination of servants, husbandmen are ruined, the farmers are disabled, manufacturers and artificers are plunged to the destruction of trade. Thompson argues that the growing unease of the elite was because labourers were becoming freer and more mobile. They had freedom to choose between employers and also between how they spent their time, on work or on leisure, although this was to end with the onset of industrialisation. He argues that the freedom had three different characteristics: the advent of payment in money rather than in kind. If payment for labour was given in the form of food and lodging by the master, then a worker was clearly more dependent upon him. Secondly, there was a growth in the sector of the population who were independent of the gentry, people like clothing workers, urban artisans, colliers, bargees, porters, labourers and petty dealers. And thirdly, he argues that the gentry were becoming increasingly remote from the populace. Their rage for deer parks and the threat of poachers led to closures of rights of way across their parks and their encirclement with high palings or walls. Landscape gardens accentuated the secrecy of their estates. The gentry then appeared only on ritualistic occasions, at the hunt, the assizes, or in the segregated pews at church. Thompson also argues that leisure became more secularized. There was a rich plebeian culture characterised by things like hobby horses, sweeps on pigs, Morris dances, baitings, wrestling, dancing and drinking. Henry Fielding commented on the evident division between the high and the low people, which he termed the people of fashion and of no fashion, writing, "Whilst the people of fashion seized several places to their own use, such as courts, assemblies, operas, balls, etc., the people of no fashion, besides one royal place called His Majesty's Bear Garden, have been in constant possession of all hops, fairs, revels, etc. So far from looking on each other as brethren in the Christian language, they seem scarce to regard each other as of the same species." Thompson did not argue that the plebeians were an emergent working class. He says they lacked consistency of self-definition, they lacked consciousness, they lacked clarity of objectives, they were disorganised. But he says that they were a political presence on crucial occasions, such as during the Sacheverell riots, during excise agitations and cider tax riots. Plebeian culture, he argued, had its own rituals, festivals and superstitions. It was distanced from polite culture and no longer acknowledged the hegemony of the church. It bred riots, but not rebellions, direct actions and not democratic organisations. He said that resistance to the gentry took three main forms. Firstly, of anonymous threats or acts. anonymous letters, arson, bricks through windows, sabotage, felling of orchards, and so on. Anonymous letters were often published in the London Gazette by their recipients looking for justice. So, for example, one from Whitney in 1767 said, "Do not suffer such damned, wheezing, fat-gutted rogues to starve the poor by such hellish ways on purpose that they may follow hunting, horse racing, etc., and to maintain their families in pride and extravagance." One from Odiham in 1800 said, "We don't care a damn for them fellows that call themselves gentlemen soldiers, but in our opinion, look more like monkeys riding on bears." And lastly, one from Norwich in 1793 said, "Lord Buckingham, who died the other day, had £30,000 yearly for setting his arse in the House of Lords and doing nothing." Secondly, the plebeians employed what E.P. Thompson has called the counter-theatre of threat and sedition. Thus, they burnt effigies, hung boots from gallows, illuminated windows, broke windows, untiled houses. It was the language of ribbons, bonfires, oaths, toasts, seditious riddles, oak leaves, maypoles, and ballads sung in the street. Thirdly, the crowd were capable of taking direct action. To be a member of a crowd gave anonymity and protection. To be a member of an organisation, on the other hand, exposed one to detection and victimisation. Crowds demanded immediate results to break machines, intimidate employers, damage mills, enforce bread subsidies, and so on. For example, this description of a food riot in Newcastle-on-Tyne in 1740 is typical. "About two on Thursday morning, a great number of colliers and wagoners, smiths and other common workmen came along the bridge, released the prisoners and proceeded in great order through the town with bagpipes playing, drums beating and dirty clothes fixed on sticks by way of colours flying. They then increased to some thousands and were in possession of the principal streets of the town. The magistrates met at the Guildhall and scarce knew what to do. The crowd broke into the hutch and took out £1,500, broke everything that was ornamental, two very fine capital pictures of King Charles II and James II. They tore all but the faces, and afterwards conducted the magistrates to their own houses in a kind of mock triumph." England was never without a standing army in the 18th century, but it was often a small and emergency force and unsuited to the maintenance of internal control. The army was often seriously overstretched. The permanent quartering of troops in districts was not encouraged. And thus there was always delay between the onset of the disturbance and the arrival of the military. Thus the state was weak, demonstrated by the license of the crowd. The elite sanction, though, of popular culture was gradually withdrawn throughout the century. The long-standing custom of bull running at Tutbury in Staffordshire illustrates this. This was where the inhabitants of the towns and villages around Needwood Forest legitimated an annual carnival, which became increasingly at odds with polite society. Eventually, the annual custom was suppressed by the Duke of Devonshire in 1778, after a petition from the town of Tutbury. Needwood Forest itself was deforested in 1801. Custom was the essential underpinning for this society. Custom dictated the local calendar in which leisure pursuits and work practices were linked to seasonal events and community activities. The reckoning of time was even customary, and this was highlighted when Britain adopted the Gregorian calendar in 1752. But fair and feast days continue to be observed in many places following the old Julian calendar. The widespread custom of St. Monday, the holiday taken at their discretion at the beginning of the week by a variety of hand workers, also demonstrated a resistance to change. Some historians, wishing to stress cultural diversity in the 18th century, have moved towards models which classify popular culture into subcultures. Barry Ray has written of poplar culture splintering into subcultures divided by locality, age, gender, religion, and class. Hugh Cunningham likewise divided it into groups. He wrote that boundaries of class, of gender, of age, and of geography are likely to be represented in leisure, and leisure activities may themselves have reinforced or shifted those boundaries and not merely reflected them. The problem with a dichotomous vision of society, whether between patrician and plebeian or polite and popular, is that variety and diversity are not easily accommodated. Oak Apple Day, the 29th of May, which was celebrated to mark the anniversary of the restoration of Charles II in 1660, was known variously in parts of Britain as Sicksack, Shigshag, Shickshack, or Zigzag Day. It is likely that this came from the term of abuse for Protestant dissenters, Shitsack, which was derived from their practice of hedgerow preaching. Thus, Oak Apple Day, formerly associated with established church, was seen as an occasion for the rebuke of dissenters. It was also appropriated by labourers to register their protests against the Hanoverian succession. As late as 1750 in Walsall, some people were charged with having made an image of the king on the 29th of May and then shooting at it. This picture, dichotomous picture between the patrician and the plebeian then, is also complicated by the emergence of the middling class towards the later 18th century. The middle class is a difficult term to define, and it's not necessarily a useful term for analysing the processes of change in the 18th century. The precise term middle class emerges at the end of the century, but the group referred to are identifiable throughout the period and termed variously the middling people of England, the middling sort, and men of a middling condition. The term bourgeoisie is even more problematic. It's a word that doesn't translate into an equivalent English term, but even in France it changed its meaning from the broad term urban dweller, via an urban rentier living off investments, to an economically active group of merchants, industrialists and financiers. Cooper termed the middling group tenants of life's middle state, securely placed between the small and great. The term then originates as an interposition between rich and poor, persons of rank and common people, and therefore it's somewhat of a negative definition. The middle class are neither working class, which implies some kind of economic role, or members of the landed propertied elite. Seed's working definition is that the middle class in the 18th century were distinguished from the aristocracy and the gentry by the need to generate an income from some kind of active occupation. They were distinguished from the labouring majority by the possession of property, whether mobile capital, stock in trade, or professional credentials, and also by their exemption from manual labour. To some extent, studies of class and class formation have been discredited by current historiographical trends. If different groups in society are not found to behave in classically oppositional ways, is the notion of class irrelevant? Or as Bourdieu has claimed, the potency of economic and social differences is never so great that one cannot organise agents on the basis of other principles of division. These other principal forms of identity could include identification with a nation, or the divisions of race, gender and sexuality. Postmodern historians have also cast doubt on the analytical and organisational category of class. Patrick Joyce, for example, in his book Visions of the People, argued that economic and linguistic conceptions, class and people respectively, exist side by side. However, as Margaret Hunt has argued, the term class emerged for contemporaries to make sense of their contemporary experiences and their observations and problems. The social surveys of the 18th century give some idea of the social hierarchy of society. At its apex were the 1% of the population who were major landowners, receiving around 15% of the annual income. At the base were the labouring poor, but in between stretched the ranks of the middling sort, ranging from judges, state officials and great merchants to small farmers and semi-independent craftsmen. And it's from these ranks that an emergent middle class can be traced. Harold Perkin, in his Origins of Modern English Society, estimated that there was an overall increase in the middling sort from around 435,000 in 1688 to 634,000 by 1803. Within this total, both farmers and professionals showed a modest increase, but the bulk of the growth came from the expansion of trade and manufacturing. However, this group is difficult to collect data on. Wealth is an alternative measure of status, but equally problematic. The possession of property, as has been argued, was an essential constituent of the middle class, and income, especially when realised in consumption, was a recognised marker of social position. For Daniel Defoe, then, the middling sort were not exposed to the miseries and hardships, the labour and suffering of the mechanic part of mankind, and not embarrassed with the pride, luxury, ambition and envy of the upper part of mankind. Leonard Schwartz, using London tax assessments, places around 2-3% of the London population in the upper income bracket. He argues that this gave them an average income of around £2,000 per annum or more. He puts 16-21% in the middling bracket, around £80-139 per annum, and the remaining 75% were a diverse body of the smaller independent artisans, wage labourers and the unemployed. This means that around 20-25% of London's population was made up of people in the middle station. John Smale, in his study of Halifax, has argued that the middling sort viewed their world in hierarchical terms, and that their social relations reflected these assumptions about the fundamental correctness of social inequalities. The important features of this social hierarchy were the dominance of the gentry and aristocracy, and the submission of the poor. However, their deference to the landed aristocracy was imbued with a strong sense of independence. Deference, though natural, was contingent. In the right circumstances, the middling sort would follow their own path. The middling sort were also socially inclusive. Social and economic differences were not a crucial part of their identity, as individuals or as a group. Margaret Hunt has emphasised that the theory of emulation, which formed a major part of studies of the middling sort in the 60s and 70s, should be re-evaluated. This theory had been established to explain why the middling sort were not as politically powerful in the 18th century as Marxists argue they should have been. But there was often a deep ambivalence, if not hostility, by the middling sort to the values of the aristocracy and gentry. For example, Samuel Thornton, a director of the Bank of England, MP for Hull and a member of a Yorkshire family heavily involved in the Russian trade, incurred the disapproval of his family when he bought a country estate, Albury Park. His brother accused him of pretending to be what he was not, for the family was all city people, and connected with merchants and nothing but merchants on every side. Middling people, especially those retiring, did purchase land, but this did not necessarily signify a desire to emulate the aristocracy. Land was a safe investment, and the world of business was a demanding one with its own personal rewards. When a friend of Samuel Kenrick, a Unitarian banker, suggested that he retire, Kenrick replied, "If I was out of the bank, in what respect would I be happier than I am now?" Thus, emulation was only one of the impulses that animated the middling sword. What trends then were crucial in the formation of the middle class? Or, as Dror Warman has argued, why and when did the British come to believe that they lived in a society centred around a middle class? Social class is something more than can be obtained by a passive and static description based on quantifiable information. Such analyses cannot uncover relationships within the middle class or with the wider society. It also cannot tell us how such relationships were changing. Class was a dynamic process, a matter of shifting social relations. And social status depended on numerous considerations, including family, by birth or marriage, property, real and personal, profession and employment, connections, politeness and breeding. All of these could be amplified or diminished by the traditions, perceptions and outlook of the communities in which they were set. There were some rags to riches stories, for example, the meteoric rise of Arkwright, Titus Salt or Samuel Cunliffe Lister. Some prospered more modestly after several generations of capital accumulation, shrewd marriages or good fortune, but many others were less fortunate, bankrupted or impoverished by fluctuations in the economy or by competition. The so-called rise of the middle class, then, obscures these stories, which were perhaps the most common. Thus, for example, only 127 out of the 318 Yorkshire woollen mills survived the major economic crisis of the 1830s and 40s. John Seed has argued that it's wrong to draw a distinction between a southern commercial middle class and a northern industrial and manufacturing middle class. Large-scale employers were scarce in the north as well as in London, and new professional and white-collar groups were emerging all over the country. This is not to propose that there was a uniform middle class evenly distributed across the towns and cities of England. There were significant and identifiable differences in the composition of the middle class between distinct economic regions. But the precise character of the middle class in each urban centre varied from district to district and from town to town. The professionals and the commercial men tended to be concentrated in regional capitals. For example, Manchester diversified its economic base, and by the early 19th century, a much smaller proportion of its population were engaged in the textile trades, but it had become a centre for professional and commercial services for the region, and thus it had a much larger middle class of bankers, lawyers, accountants, agents, merchants, etc. Similar-sized towns could produce entirely different profiles of their middle class. So, how was middle class identity formed? Of primary importance, then, is the family or the private sphere, as we've already discussed. Most businesses were family affairs until the late 19th century. The main business unit was the owner or manager, or a small partnership, often consisting of family members. Management functions were usually carried out by members of the family, perhaps supported by a small group of clerks, overseers and foremen. The family provided capital as well as personnel. Marriage partners were thus crucially important, and groups of loosely connected families engaged in similar economic interests became increasingly integrated. Central to this cultural identity, and thus central to the emerging distinction between public and private spheres, was a new set of gender relations. The expectation that the woman of a family would not work suggests the differentiation between a male sphere that included business, politics and local affairs, and a female sphere that encompassed other activities. The removal of women from the workforce was a major change between families of the middling sort and those of the middling class. In the middling sort, work and living were inseparable. For the middle class, the business premises and the private home were physically different spaces. A second important factor then was religion. The middle class were overwhelmingly affiliated to organised religion. Membership of a congregation was an insignia of middle class status and linked the middle class family with a wider community. Sociability was thus controlled, and potential marriage partners could be carefully supervised. Co-religionists also often provided capital to expand businesses. The social values propounded by the churches and chapels gave ideological legitimacy to patterns of middle-class life, the domination of male over female, of parents over children, of masters over servants. Membership of a religious congregation was commitment to a whole social project. A third element was the development of the secular public sphere, which transcended the divisive boundaries of the different religious sects. The social world of the middling sort was determined largely by work and residence, but the emerging middle class had a sense of a distinct social status and strong gender differences, and thus created new forms of sociability. For example, they established bodies such as subscribing libraries, literary and philosophical societies, assembly rooms, and debating societies. Such groups also became more exclusive during the 18th century, and these new forms of sociability, as we've seen, were also differentiated by gender. These new forms of sociability were making a class identity by creating a distinctive social space for the commercial and the professional elite. For example, we can look at the social world of the alehouse, which was perhaps indicative of the social world of the middling sort in the early 18th century. The alehouse was a place where men and women who lived in the area could congregate, when neither status nor gender were particularly strong social markers. For the middle class, by the end of the 18th century, sociability was more orderly and exclusive, and it had been differentiated into public and private spheres. Thus, two parallel institutions, the male club and the mixed assembly, replaced the middling sort's alehouse. As we've seen, the local context is crucial when looking for the origins of the middle class. But towards the end of the 18th century, Drawer Warman has identified the 1790s as the crucial decade. There was a transition from the local to the national, a process in which local class cultures were articulated in wider and wider arenas. This process is described in Leonora Davidoff and Catherine Hall's book Family Fortunes by the example of Isaac Taylor and his family, and the struggle they had in maintaining their middle-class identity, which had been forged in London, among the villagers of Lavenham in Suffolk. Obviously, they write, a middle-class culture could not have originated in such a context. Davidoff and Hall argue that the family brought their middle-class culture with them from London and refreshed it through letter writing, reading, and the occasional visit to the metropolis. Thus, gradually a national middle-class consciousness influenced the local context. So a middle-class culture existed on two levels. On the regional and national level, it was often an abstract but nevertheless coherent articulation of political, cultural and economic ideas that appear most vividly when they form political and social action. This national middle-class culture was also appropriated in specific local contexts because it allowed groups to make sense of the political implications of their social and economic experience. It's been argued then that the national articulation of these middle class values occurred as a result of a series of political, social and economic crises, notably the war with the American colonies, the French Revolution and the war with France, the pressure for political reform, and increasing economic tensions between labour and capital. However, we have to remember that these broader national articulations of middle-class culture came from the myriad local, mainly urban contexts where the process of economic change transformed the middling sort into the middle class.